Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Hero with a Thousand Potions podcast, a gaming podcast where two game-likers in their 30s discuss the storytelling and gameplay of popular and niche RPGs in a book club-like format. I'm Tyler.
I am Nate.
It's true. It is Nate. It's season two. We're covering Final Fantasy VII Remake and its parallel content in the original game released back in 1997. And today we are coming to the end of chapter 17, probably get where chapter 18 begins, but we're getting right at that margin there as we have just completed the Genova Dreamweaver boss and we're going to start fleeing the Shinra Tower. Nate, are you excited to wrap up this season?
Yeah, because I'm like living in two worlds where I'm playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, and yet I can't really talk about any of it with you, and I can't really interject any of my feelings about it into this particular podcast. So once we're done with this and you kind of use your extra time to get caught up, we'll be back in sync. I feel like we were in sync playing through this game, and we could play it more frequently than we could talk about it due to our life situation. And so we're playing catch up a little bit on, we used to just like banter on our off time of like, this is something that's interesting. That's something that's interesting. Did you notice this in the notes, etc., you know? And
yeah.
We can't really do that with the actual games we're playing right now due to spoilerage and secrets.
Spoilerage and secrets.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true, Nate. How's your life? How are you doing?
My life is fine. It's the same. I'll say this. World of Warcraft, a game comes up a lot on this podcast because I'm a hopeless fanboy. It did the most Blizzard thing ever in that they finally released the Battle Royale mode in World of Warcraft today, as of the time that we're recording this, not as the time that you listener will be hearing it. Plunderstorm, it's called, and it's like a pirate battle royale game, right? And the reason I say it's like the most Blizzard thing ever is because, in my opinion, battle royale games are like based on an underlying theme of player abuse, in that they involve a small gambling element of you are randomly rolling whether your game is going to be good or not, whether you're going to be a piece of shit or you're going to dominate everyone through loot boxes and drops at every turn. You largely step into a game where you don't know the mechanics and you're learning it on the fly. So it's like heavily at the beginning of the game, whoever has the best shit is just going to automatically win, because when everyone's new and fresh, there's not a lot of skill at play. So I believe these games have like an underlying algorithm, and I think this exists in like Hearthstone Battle Royale, or Battlegrounds as it's called, and other games made by Blizzard, where like after you lose enough, it starts automatically delivering you some like good rolls so that you aren't compelled to quit. And so I feel like it's a very abusive model because it's playing on your emotions more than a traditional PvP or PvE game would. You get that rush of a win and you're like, oh, I'm getting better, I'm getting good. And then you get stomped four more times and you feel like shit. And then the game recognizes like, oh, they logged off. Next time they log in, I'm going to give them a win.
So this is like a Fortnite in Azeroth?
Yes, exactly. 100%. And that goes great for Blizzard because they are well known for being abusers in real life as well. It's like a match made in heaven. And I hopped in and I played one of it. I'm like, yes, this is legitimately everything I hate about Battle Royales. So yeah, great.
I want more.
Exactly.
Or maybe you don't. I don't know.
I don't know. I want the rewards they give. I'm a collector. That's fun to me. But generally, I've drawn the line now in my adulthood of I don't feel like I want to collect anything that is not fun in the process of collecting it. So if the gameplay sucks or it's tedious or I'm spending money, I do not think I'm going to collect that thing anymore. That 15 years ago, that might have not been my take on it. So I will try a couple more times, but if it keeps sucking, that loot will just stay uncollected.
Nate has self-control now.
Something like that. I have also a backlog that would, you could drop on a small country and it would eradicate them.
You could choke a donkey with.
Choke a donkey.
So that's not my life, but that's something that is of interest to me.
Cool. And we're going to skip me because you've heard enough about my ups and downs. I want to get into it.
Let's do it.
Okay. I feel like at the end of last episode, we could have ended it after what happens after the Genova fight, but we're going to start with what happens immediately after you slay Genova Dreamweaver, where the cavern we're fighting in disappears, and we're back in President Shinra's office, and the creature is revealed to be one of those hooded Marcus types who collapses and disintegrates into dust. The true Genova specimen is on the floor beside it, I noticed in the frame, and Sephiroth manifests again. I guess there's a second Marcus in the room, and picks it up. But it's cloaked in a cloak. We don't get to see Genova's body. It's in a wrap. And then he teleports to the helipad and then floats upwards out of view. This is a remake, of course, not original.
Yeah, and when you think about original, we never saw any black cloaked figures within the Shinra building in original at all. We never saw Sephiroth. We just saw the sword in the president's back and like Palmer saying he was here, you know, and so we didn't get that hint that these dudes can manifest a Sephiroth. This thing in remake is very dependent on knowledge of how this all works from the standpoint of late OG / Advent Children, as I've said before. So if you are playing remake for the first time, this might be hella confusing or just a little bit too mysterious to make any sense. It's pretty like apparent what's going on, but the why of it is not really there. And the other thing that kind of begs the question is Marcus, the Marcus types that we see in remake, they come out the gates swinging in their black cloaks. But in OG, we meet these guys sprinkled about the slums, and they're not wearing black cloaks. They're not like doing weird shit. They're just dudes that are hanging out going, and people are saying, oh, this is like, we've known this guy forever. He's sick. Marcus, we know about him. He's staying at the inn. The Tifa's looking after him. There wasn't any indication that there's a cult of like sick dudes that all wear the exact same cloak with the exact same logo printed on it. If these dudes are all walking around incapable of normal function, who's painting the mural on all of the cloaks? That's a huge question I would have of like, obviously there's some central figure doing this to these people.
What's that logo again? Is like a white angel, long streaky vertical lines that make it look very harrowing and spooky,
almost like a Reaper angel type of thing.
Treading
that line between Grim Reaper and angel, which, I mean, there is some argument that the Grim Reaper is an angel, the angel of death, so that's there. But like in OG, you wouldn't have any of those questions. You just kind of like, oh yeah, we've met a couple sick guys with tattoos, but there's no like indication that they're part of an organization of dudes like this.
Yeah, that's true.
And the other question, we jumped through how many hoops to get to the top of the Shinra building? And one of them is just like chilling. So I don't know, is like Sephiroth, this is off screen, is he like popping in and out and being like, all right, I'm using you, Timmy, and I'm going to fly to the top of the building, because we can see that he can fly to the top of the building, kill the president, grab Genova, you know, whatever, or grab Genova, kill the president. Is he the one getting them up there? That's a question I have.
Somebody tell us. God knows how we got up there with all of our hoops, the hoops we had to jump through and our key cards and our, I don't think one of those Marcus types could even ascend 20 staircases, much less 59. Then again, they are going to cross the world on foot. So we see our escape helicopters ready to pick us up, but we turn to Barret and that white mage whisper has got him all patched up. And we get a chance to thank it before it goes floating back off to its friends. And again, I mean, we talked about this, but I feel like what's the point of all this nonsense? And this particular sympathetic whisper, this is the language of film, because modern video games feel like they must mimic the language of film because they're filmic now, they're cinematic. We have cinematic RPGs in front of us. The thing does its noble deed, turns around and gives a cute little kind of goodbye, thank you, like you've seen in other movies before it scampers off back to its family.
Right.
I mean, it's these beats are the things we've seen before. And Barret's fine. Barret's good. No punctured lung, no arterial destruction. You can breathe just fine.
You know, we talked about the point a little bit. I'll also hammer home that Barret was also the one who gave that speech in Aerith's old room where he said, terrible shit is going to happen to us. We just got to lie down and accept it because that's fate. I think this is showing the other side of that coin of if you're fated to survive, that benefits you. So it's not a super strong connection because I don't feel like he didn't deliver any dialogue that like, you know, that's like poetry or rhymes, right? He didn't deliver any dialogue that made that connection for me. But if there's anything I can pull on, he was the one that was seeming fatalistic about the existence of the Whispers. And this is kind of the other side of that coin of the Whispers can benefit you if you're within the grace of fate.
Yes, you were fated to live.
Yeah.
And naughty Sephiroth violated that. And so you will continue to go on living.
Why did Sephiroth do it knowing this guy's basically immortal? Like, he has to know how this works, right? Is he making a demonstration for us?
Sephiroth doesn't know that the Jenova Dreamweaver fight requires 3 party members, not 4.
Yes.
And so we need to incapacitate one. Then again, actually, in a future boss fight, Barret will participate as a combat unit, but will not actually be a playable character. So I don't know if that holds very much water in hindsight.
The Red 13 is present in a lot of fights in which he is just not playable whatsoever in the finale of this game.
Absolutely right. So before we get over to that rendezvous helicopter, the Cloud follows Sephiroth up an antenna tower. But Whispers try to knock Cloud off his ladder partway up. Cloud's not supposed to waylay this particular visage of Sephiroth as it ascends this antenna tower. That's what it's telling us, because it's the will of the planet. But Sephiroth is revealed to be another hooded figure. We get a close-up shot of the number 2 on his shoulder. It's relevant that this is number 2, I guess. Number 2 tattoo. Number 2, Marcus. And it free falls off the Shinra Tower with Jenova's body in its arms. So this is Sephiroth recovering the Jenova body or head. I guess it is the body, right? And all the Whispers go diving after it, presumably to ensure that this particular hooded man survives the fall.
For OG spoiler sake, the head is taken in Nibelheim 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot that.
The thing about Jenova in these scenes, you see this like body of a woman wrapped up in cloth. It looks kind of just like a woman, and we know we had the Jenova boss fight, but we also have seen Jenova in OG in several forms, and we know that like she doesn't necessarily look like that. And so you've played Resident Evil 2 Remake. You've also played Parasite Eve, so you've extra seen this, how they like to take figures of like normal things, and then they just like explode out into evolutionary expressions of masses of flesh. It kind of makes me wonder, this Jenova we've known, is that like a mutation of sorts? Does she have the ability to, when she came and kind of seduced humanity, or you know wove her deception to create humans apart from the ancients? Those of us who have played OG know that kind of lore. Did she come to the ancients like posing as just a human woman and not the giant monstrosity that she was, and so there's an ability to kind of fold Jenova up back into that form, because he's not holding a giant clumpy 20-foot tall mass of flesh.
That's true. I thought she you've exposed a presumption of mine that you're probably gonna really mine. I thought she arrived at the planet dead.
That's interesting. I'm thinking about that. The lore that's in my head is that she crash landed out of whatever, there's that big wound in the planet from it. And out of that, Jenova like came, essentially seduced the Cetras, a number of them, not all of them, and corrupted them. And those people are humans that broke away from the Cetra and became infected by Jenova. Is that wrong? I feel like that's in a passage somewhere, that basically the people who, after the calamity from the skies, broke away from the Cetra are just regular humans. Do you have an Ultimania that can provide this answer?
I can look, man.
Okay.
I don't know if that has it. There's a second Ultimania, actually, free rebirth, that I don't have, that may say more about this.
Wait, a second remake Ultimania?
Yeah.
What the fuck? What about the original, like, 1997-7 Ultimania?
That's a picture book.
Okay, there is no
lore for the most part.
All right, well, that was my theory, is Jenova showed up, saw that like, oh, these ancients are wise to my ways, so I'm gonna have to like seduce them, fuck with them, to disconnect them from their like communion with the planet, otherwise they'll be too strong, like they'll stop me. So
wow, okay. No, I thought she came in, crashed in, poisoned the planet, and her impregnation of the planet with her magic was picked up by ancients and turned to good use by ancients without knowing where it came from. But you're describing Genova to me like as if she were a prophet.
Okay. Well, beyond that, my theory does not explain how did she end up in like frozen in a geological stratum, as it's called in the game. I do not have an explanation for the time between her arrival and that. Yours gives me that she crash landed, got stuck, and just her poison. And we have Advent Children gives an explanation for this. There's this ability to infect the life stream with the malignant hatred of Sephiroth and Genova and create a disease out of it. So, you know, hey, you're probably closer to a resolution and an answer than I am with my theory.
Interesting. Interesting.
What up? Post-production Nate here about this whole discussion with Genova and what Genova is and how she or it works. I'm pulling the things that I was referencing in my mind. I'm pulling up the script of it right here. And part one of this comes from Dr. Gast's tapes with Aerith's mother, Ephalna, in Icicle, the town of Icicle on the northern continent. And in the tape, Dr. Gast is asking what happened to the ancients. And Ephalna says, when the Cetra were preparing to part with the land they loved, that's when it appeared. It looked like our dead mothers, our dead brothers, showing us specters of their past. Who is that person that appeared at the northern cave? I haven't any idea, Dr. Gast asks. Ephalna says, that's when the one who injured the planet, or the crisis from the sky, as we call it, came. It first approached us as a friend, deceived them, and finally gave them the virus. The Cetra were attacked by the virus and went mad, transforming into monsters. Then, just as it had done at Noel's Pole, it approached the other Cetra clans, infecting them with the virus. And that's where the explanation ends on that one. Now, in a separate scene, when Sephiroth is reading Dr. Gast's collected works in the Nibelheim Mansion basement, Sephiroth says, in regards to the Cetra and the ancients, Sephiroth says, but those that disliked the journey appeared, those who stopped their migrations, built shelters, and elected to lead an easier life. They took that which the Cetra and the planet had made without giving back one whit in return. Those are your ancestors. The planet was saved by sacrificing the Cetra. After that, your ancestors continued to increase. So I'm pulling from two separate passages, and on face value, they probably aren't related. But in my head as a kid, I had this idea that when Ephalna refers to the Cetra being transformed into monsters, and then Sephiroth says how people appeared among the Cetra who were dissatisfied or disgruntled with the journey, I'm kind of correlating those two things together of essentially Genova's virus was one of like freeing people's mind from the rigid adherence to the Cetra's connection with the planet. That would deem them monsters to them, people who were selfish and greedy and did not have a connection with the planet anymore. And so who knows, maybe they're literal monsters. They transformed into disgusting hulking husks like Genova herself. But that was my interpretation back in the day, 20 plus years ago. So that's what I'm talking about. We'll get back into the discussion here.
Oh my God, the helicopter explodes, Nate. The Turk's helicopter blows up our escape rendezvous helicopter because it's got a fucking Gatling gun on it.
Yeah, is this like the fourth time Wedge has died?
Oh yeah, I don't think he was on it though, but
oh, okay.
He articulated that one was on its way.
Oh, gotcha. A red shirt was flying it.
Yes, a very brave red shirt.
Red shirt avalanche member.
Whispers, do not go reassembling the helicopter. This helicopter was meant to explode. And then the Turk's helicopter lands. We get a shot inside the helicopter where Reno says, sure you want to do this personally, boss? And then a handsome as fuck young man with fair skin, ivory hair, leaves the helicopter rolling a coin between his knuckles. This is Rufus. And what the fuck is going on with his outfit?
Yes.
This is White Mage Lulu from Final Fantasy X, except the straps aren't all like intersecting with one another. If you haven't played FF10, I don't want to sound like everyone has. But if you haven't, there's a playable character named Lulu who's got a dress made up of black belts that are all like coming at one another at like oblique angles. There's like 50 belts that make up the skirt of her dress. This character has cloth or leather straps that like run down across, like down his legs, down his pant legs, not in a dress-like way, but in a weird, obnoxious, I'm a video game character sort of way. Nate, what's the name of that character designer that designed Lulu and probably had a hand in this guy too?
This guy is not just the character designer. He's got his fingers in everything when it comes to this game. That would be Tetsuya Nomura.
I knew that. Thank you.
See, the thing about Lulu is like everybody ripped on it and thought it was ridiculous, but it's like Lulu's a black mage. She is very, I don't want to say BDSM, but like dark, witchy coded, like rightfully. The idea of a black mage and like leather and straps, there's something about it that works for me with Lulu's dress. It's impractical and it doesn't make sense, but that's fine because she is otherworldly in a way. But this dude is like giving meetings in this fucking outfit and he looks terrible. I hate everything about this. I don't know what it was. I think I saw some art back in the day that made so much more sense for Rufus. And I don't know if it was official art or what it was, but it was all of the Turks in their signature black outfits. And then Rufus in just a white suit opposite the Turks. He was their leader, and we kind of know that they answer to him, and we'll see that at kind of at the end of this chapter here, or like the culmination of the game. If the president's golf got all these like business type, development type sycophants surrounding him, Rufus has his Turks, and the simplicity of that like white suit opposite his men having the black suit, the idea that they get their hands in the dirt, they're dark, they're dirty, they're in the shadows, and he's the poster boy, the pretty boy that everybody looks at and cheers, and the yin and yang of all of that and the relationship, but essentially they are one and the same, right? He's the one giving all of these guys the orders. It was perfect and it made so much sense, and it kind of pisses me off how bad this character design is in comparison to, and he looks great in original too, so it's like I said it in season one, Elvis's stupid anime pants. This is Rufus's stupid anime coat.
Yes. Oh, it's the coat, right? It's not his pants.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is Rufus, President Shinra's son, and he's cool. I might be reading into it, but I think Rufus and Cloud's complexion and their face looks awful similar. And so it feels to me like Rufus could be a corporate mirror image of Cloud.
Okay.
And more reading into it, the coat reminds me of like the shredded Marcus hooded figure robes too, because they're also kind of shredded. I'm not drawing a particular line in between these two. I'm just saying they look a lot the same. Cloud says he'll cover his teammate's escape as he confronts this new foe. And Rufus goes, you're a soldier, weren't you? Which means I own you. Cloud goes, ex-soldier, I quit.
You're a soldier, aren't you? Which, of course, would mean that I own you.
Ex-soldier.
And then Rufus goes, guess it's just the two of us. And then the demonic guard dog shows up. Maybe three.
I'll say this. I think Rufus's voice actor is probably one of my favorites in the game. He's very short recording time, for sure. Tifa has grown on me. In this playthrough of Remake, I didn't like her originally, but this time around, Tifa's grown on me for sure. And I see a little bit more of why that particular tone of character voice was chosen now, replaying the game for the second time now. But especially this time, I feel like Rufus just nails his character with his tone. Because that line you dropped, let's just play the clip. The way he says, that means I own you. It encapsulates his character. Very early on in the podcast, I talk about Cloud's smirk communicating his character to us. I feel like this whole scene with Rufus, the way he arrives in OG, because you don't have voice acting, you almost wonder like, who is this guy? What's his angle? What's he going at here? I mean, obviously, he's going to inherit the presidency. Is he going to hate us? Is he going to be pissed and avenge his dad? Is he going to play it cool? What motivates Rufus? And I think in Remake, you get to immediately tap into who this character is from the added cinematicness of the scene here and the voice actor.
Is it worth looking up who the voice actor is?
Sure.
I'm seeing Josh Bowman.
Yes.
Who, oh, it's the, I guess he's fresh on the scene and he's got two voice credits. One is Rebirth, one is Remake.
For the sake of video games, yes, but it looks like he's done a lot of TV.
Handsome dude.
Very handsome dude. Kind of reminds me...
Rob McElhenney of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
I couldn't place it, but yeah, you nailed it.
I did nail it.
He's sick in the fact that like he just decided like one day, I'm kind of fat. I guess I'll just become a paragon of shredded male muscle in 3 months. And then he went and did it.
He did.
Yeah, that's insane.
Man has self-control.
Yeah. Anyway, great job, Josh. Keep it up. Proud of you.
Yeah, so very much like OG. And we'll address OG momentarily. But we fight. This is a one-on-two fight between Cloud and Rufus and Darkstar. And it feels like a summation of all the other major one-on-one fights that we've had. This guy is fast. Darkstar is challenging. In my first playthrough, it took me 3 or 4 tries before I got him down. I got this fight completed, a couple different phases. Of course, he's got the shotgun. He had the shotgun in original. He's got it here too. He's firing it at us. He flips a coin and then he hits the coin with his shotgun and it fires these great big laser beams at you. He's got a smoke screen. He can parry and knock you away if you're fighting improperly. Punisher mode works pretty well against him. Interrupting him when he reloads is really, really important. I have no idea how hard this is on hard mode, but I can only guess it's super, super difficult.
He dashes not by being like super fast, not by like having Goku powers, but by shooting his gun on the ground and having that fling him across the room. And he's very experienced in using this technique.
Yeah, he's excellent wrist control. This guy propels himself like a jet, like a shuttle around with the gun. It's ridiculous.
Now in OG, when you're fighting a Turk, Reno just runs up and smacks you with a rod. Or Rude will just run up and punch you. Rufus will just shoot you with a gun. So like these are all just humans in OG, right? And in Remake, these are all like anime superhero characters in some respect. They're doing crazy flips, warping around at light speed. From one technique to another, they find a way to match Cloud's soldier abilities tit for tat. So I wonder, do the Turks go through a round of Mako enhancing soldier treatments as well?
I don't think so.
We haven't heard of anyone like suffering degradation or weird shit like soldier members have, but it's like Rufus is going toe to toe with an ex-soldier. The Turks are unfazed by soldier members. So are they're just really, really, really good at what they do? Is that what I'm to believe from this?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're handpicked from the academy to be part of the elite squad and they get properly vetted. And if they're decidedly brutal and cruel and capable of doing the utmost loyalty to their boss, then they'll go very far.
Right. Tifa, we know, is like super capable as well from training as a monk. She's just really good, right? Zangan trained her and overnight she learned also how to warp across the screen and like zip like a ninja, I guess. Anyway.
How was this fight for you, Nate?
Well, as always, I take out the dog first. I focus the dog. He's an ad.
Yes.
You know, and you deal with the ads first. We're in a string of boss fights as the game finishes. We've got Genova. Now we're on Rufus. And for whatever reason, this is the clearest the game has felt for me being in combat situations. It almost feels like they made these first. These were some of the first fights they spent the most time on. They had the most time refining these. They'll come back to something. They'll add a new mechanic or they'll be refining an element of the combat as development continues on. And they'll say, okay, well, we're going to touch up this aspect of the Genova fight. We're going to revisit this in the Rufus fight, etc. Every one of these fights feels very visually stimulating and visually communicative to the point where like it feels good to play and I know how I'm dying and what I'm doing wrong immediately.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Weird shit happening. Even when you do assess like earlier boss fights, that ghost thing where it was just like you assess, it tells you how to beat it basically. And then there's just weird things with like geometry clipping and the junk in the room and like, I cannot cast a single spell because I'm always getting hit by a chair flipping around the room. Every single time I try and start a spell, like, something stupid happens to my character and they're knocked on their ass. And it's so unsatisfying. Like I said, the end of the game was designed first, and they had the most time to refine these and, like, revisit these and play test these, because all of these feel so pointed, so perfect, immediately visually stimulating in a way, like we said with Genova, the tentacles come up, the shit's on the floor that you can't stand in, and we as players know exactly what we're supposed to do. So, like, Rufus, he's telegraphing his attacks. They're quick, they're fast. You got to react to them with good timing, but you aren't left wondering, like, what the fuck is going on? What is happening? And you're keeping your eye, the dog circling around you, flanking you. And so, very great fight and very challenging, but also when I screw up, I know why and I know what I need to do differently. And that's something that I've explained in prior episodes where I'm just like, I need more of this in my combat. And so these fights are really delivering and I loved it.
I agree with you. That's a pretty good assessment. Like, you articulate something that I haven't really thought about, but this isn't the most, like, exciting or gimmicky fight, or when I say exciting, I mean, like, explosive and colorful and, oh my God, what the hell is this creature? It is a pretty straightforward fight, but in terms of, like, mechanics and understanding and the quote-unquote tactile feedback you get from being bad and improving, it is a good fight. Mm-hmm. That's a fair comment. I also focused Dark Star down first. My build was all non-magic. I used the highest base attack sword I got, which is the Hard Edge. Chakra, ATB up when you defend, health up, barrier materia, I guess that is a spell. Just, like, raw, like, warrior stuff.
Right.
And that's what got me through. Although I think that Dark Star does have a, like, an elemental weakness that was negligible to me, I guess.
Chakra, how's that working out for you? I've always found, because it's based on you taking damage, is it giving you satisfactory healing? What's the window in which you need to perform the heal after the fact?
I'm glad you asked that, actually. This is something I learned from speedrunning Earthbound, funny enough, where you have a policy. You don't let your health get to a certain point where you're like, oh my God, I need to use a chakra now. And my policy is about 40% health. Like, you're just going to use chakra next.
Okay.
And I don't bank an AT bar for it. I just bear that in mind and kind of organize events such that I'm able to.
Right.
So, like, we don't want to talk about Earthbound speedrunning, but there are some fights where it's like, if your health hits this number, you heal yourself in this manner. If your health hits this number, you heal yourself in this other manner. And that's how you get through a particular fight. If you are an Earthbound person, that's the Cop Gauntlet.
Right.
And I'm appropriating that here, where you just don't fall below 40% ever. That's how I leveraged it. And I've been using and leveling up a chakra over the course of the game. So this isn't a 1-star, 2-star material. This is a 4 or 5. It's one I've been leaning on all game long.
Nice. So if you hit 40%, you pop it. Are you going back to full health?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm at, like, probably 80.
That's good to know. Not to talk about Rebirth, but I'm playing it right now. I've been learning to experiment more because I have this feeling that Remake has this system of there's just a certain amount of damage you are going to take from the game, and you need to just know how to triage that in some degree. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm bad at Remake. And as I transition into this second game in the series, it's delivering more options for, like, you just don't have to take damage at all. You don't have to do that. Or if you take damage, there's an immediate solution other than cure. And so maybe I was just missing those elements in Remake, or the communication wasn't there. Because I think Rebirth tutorializes the game a little bit better, and I almost want to go back and play Remake afterwards, knowing what I know now. And so, like, chakra would be one of those things I might experiment with more, because I think in Remake I used it once and it sucked. Like, I used an ATB to get a minuscule amount of health back, and then I was like, well, cure is gonna bring me to full, so fuck this thing, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not having mana issues, not having MP issues, so why bother?
Sure.
But if it's reliable for you, then by all means, I should give it another look.
I leveraged it a lot this game.
Sweet. I think we can hop on the Rufus train on original, because this is like a convergence point where we leave the guy behind after this, for the most part.
All right, well, we'll return to original. So after we see the scene with the sword and President Shinra's back, we hear the flutter of a helicopter coming down outside, and it is the Turk's helicopter descending. Palmer races to it, because that's how he's going to get out of here. Remember, Palmer's in the scene, right? He's going to live to be a smarmy fuck off for another day. And Barrett goes, oh, that's right. Rufus, vice president, president's son. And so we follow Palmer to the helipad. We have a shot of the helipad now, and Palmer races up to Rufus, says something that doesn't have any text, like he gestures to Rufus and then runs off screen. Rufus says, who are you? And then each of us, each party member, has a little clapback that they want to share with them. Cloud goes, ex-soldier, first class. Barrett says, I'm from Avalanche. Tifa says, me too. Aerith says, a flower girl from the slums. Red 13 goes, a research specimen. Each major character in the game seems to have a custom animation. Cloud has a few of them. He's the main character. Of course he is. Tifa has her little, like, curtsy. Barrett's got his gun. And Rufus has a hair toss. He runs his hands through his hair and he shakes his head. And we get to see it for the first time here. And I just have to laugh because this gesture is an articulation of his vanity. No, I don't know if it's a vanity, but a sort of a different flavor of dismissiveness above other people. And we're going to see, assuming you play throughout OG, you're going to see this more and more. The hand running through the hair. And I have to laugh and see it here. Now, he's got a kind of like a orange hair color to him in OG. His hair is more fair and blonde in remake. I think that's a fair change.
OG's so colorful in its sprite work. There's something that people has been said about the character designs in Final Fantasy games, that when characters are designed, the people that actually implement them in the game don't want too many characters running around with like the exact same hair color or the like exact same recognizable skin color or anything like that, because they feel like on screen it becomes a little bit too samey in like picking your characters apart. So Rufus is always depicted in art as being as blonde as Cloud is, but in the game, yeah, he has this kind of like vibrant orangey hair color. A famous example of that though was Terra from Final Fantasy VI has green hair in the game despite all of her character her being blonde. And the reason for that is the people like actually implementing the character into the game itself, they were like, yeah, we were referencing the art and literally every character was blonde. So like Locke got gray hair. I think Setzer maybe got gray hair as well. And Terra got green hair because they're like, in all of our reference art we were given, all the characters are blonde. Sabin, Edgar, like everyone was blonde.
I never thought about it like that. And the other major heroine in the game is a decidedly blonde character, Celeste.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. So maybe that's just a little bit like the character designers being like, okay, I'm just going to change his palette slightly. Like you said, in Remake, there's almost this sameness between Cloud and Rufus in that they don't look exactly the same, but they have the same general features of their face, kind of the like soft pointed chin and I don't know eyes to them, that they look very anime character. It like this game has this realistic anime look to it where everybody has like detectable skin pores on their skin, but they still have eyes bigger than their nose.
Yes, almond eyes like aliens.
Right.
One difference between Cloud and Rufus: Cloud woke up today and thought, I'm not gonna dress like an idiot.
Yes. It's funny though, you mentioned the hair flip. I'll mention Street Fighter, the character of Guile. He's this no nonsense Air Force hard, tough brawler. In all of his depictions, he's not quippy, funny, like jovial. He's just straight laced and ready to throw down in a fight at any moment to get his revenge. Except he carries with him a comb, like a switchblade comb that you, it's like a knife, but it flips out and it's a comb. I don't even know what it's called. It's like inspired by Dolph Lundgren in Rocky, where he's got the flat top.
That's right, it is, isn't it?
And so he keeps that comb with him at all times because during a fight, a strand of hair might get put out of place. So when he wins, he pulls out the comb and straightens his hair back up into perfect shape. I don't know if that's like a military regulation adherence thing or if it's his personal image, but maybe that's where Rufus is coming from. I'm putting out this image of this professional man, and if a single strand of my hair is out of place, it's going to make me not look like the poised, commanding individual that I am.
Cloud holds Rufus at bay while the rest of us flee. But we don't go straight into a fight. Well, we do go into a fight, but it's not the fight between Cloud and Rufus. The game gives me an opportunity to empty allies' materials with the switch button. So I'm playing this on the Steam Deck, and it's the silly like PC port, and the instructions on the screen of telling me what buttons push what do not correlate to what buttons I have on my Steam Deck. And so when it tells me to empty allies' materials with the switch button that I don't have, so I'm going to later find out that that's the L1 button, but I don't have an opportunity to do that. And so I actually get into this fight with Darkstar and Rufus without anything, or without making any adjustments. However, I did come ready with a limit break ready to go, so I cross-slash Darkstar, he's out. Then I throw hazardous materials and grenades at Rufus. But by the way, hazardous materials that cast Bio-2 and did about 70 damage, and grenades do about 150 damage, and they go down easy. So this was unusually challenging for me, the Rufus-Darkstar fight. I also gotta say, it's really fun to see the helicopter kind of loitering around in the air in the background of the battle screen over the course of this fight. There's a little bit of a hard mode for me. Unusually so, because in OG, old as we are now, we're kind of face rolling through some of the content, really.
Speaking of face rolling, I didn't do it this playthrough for the sake of the podcast, but there was a time in my life where I loved, for whatever reason, it's like a piece of joy to have something super early in the game and just obliterate things. So I have straight up dropped Meteor Rain on Rufus and Darkstar and killed them in one ability.
So, wow.
Yeah, I was like, this is ridiculous.
Wow, dude. That's insane.
The way to get a Meteor Rain is to defeat 200 enemies in battle after you have obtained Blade Beam.
Gross.
How do you get Blade Beam? Defeat 120 enemies in battle.
Nate, tell me, is this before or after you got a memory card for your PS1?
This is much, much later after. But you want to know an interesting fact? Cross-slash you get by using Braver 8 times. So you would think, okay, I'm playing the game, been using my limit breaks, I get cross-slash. But Blade Beam is defeat 120 enemies in battle. I regularly get Blade Beam before I get Cross Slash because that's the way I grind. It's so efficient. I'm not using limit breaks. I'm not even getting hit. I have I'll find a patch of enemies. I know what their weaknesses are. I'll just buy a ton of ethers with the gold I farm, the gil I farm, and then just drop the spell on them, kill them, rinse, repeat over and over. Once you get an all materia, it's cakewalk. One of the places, the Sector 6 slums with the, you can get into a fight, there's five of those Dune teeth monsters or Sarlaccs from Star Wars, if you want to go that direction. You know what I'm talking about? Are they Gorgers? Is that what they're called?
Yep.
So there's five of them in a row. I think you have all at that point. Either that or I come back here later and you just all fire them. You're done. You can just grind like crazy. You can level up like crazy there. So pretty easy to get your limit breaks tapped out, dropping Meteor Rain on Rufus.
Wild. So we got a little bit of ahead of ourselves in OG. What technically happens after you part ways with Cloud parts ways with the party is the rest of the gang goes back down to the lower level, the level below the executive office. Tifa feels compelled to hang back and thinks Cloud's going to need some help, although she doesn't participate in the fight. And then you rebuild your party with just Barret, Red 13, and Aerith. This is the first opportunity to play Red 13 in battle. He fights with headdresses because he's a jump and spinny, slashy, agile little beast. And the damage he deals is based upon the headdress that he equips. And his original limit break is called Sled Fang, which charges at one enemy, doing non-elemental damage equal to 3 times his normal damage amount. It looks and feels wildly unimpressive compared to most other limit breaks I've seen so far in this game.
He looks like he's a car peeling out, spinning his tires, and then finally catches traction and just slams through the enemy.
It does good damage, but just looks a little kind of like whatever. And we get into the tube elevator and we're descending down the Shinra building through the tube elevator. And we get into kind of like a double boss, like a sequential boss fight in the tube elevator. versus 100 Gunner. And it looks an awful lot like Valkyrie did, didn't it, Nate?
Right.
This helicopter mech. We fight that first. The battle screen is very stylish, where our allies are on one descending elevator and our foes are on the other. And we shoot and attack one another across the chasm of the two elevators as we're descending down the building. Now, if it's 1997 and you played RPGs up until now, you've never seen dynamic battle environments like this in turn-based battling. This was pretty crazy. Then again, you have seen some descending elevator fights. Chrono Trigger comes to mind in the Ocean Palace, but not in a 3D sort of way. The 100 Gunner shoots out the glass between the two tubes before the fight begins. It's a special little thing that, I don't know, marks the beginning of the fight. And then as you fight the 100 Gunner, it progressively disintegrates as the fight goes on. And the fight goes on for quite a while. In my case, I thought it was hit a lot of health. You really just have to lightning him. If you're fighting in Midgar, there's going to be a lot of mechs you're going to fight. Someone should have lightning equipped. Oh my god, Nate, I've got this backwards. I'm not going to change it. Let's stand by it. Okay, I described the Heli Gunner, but I'm really talking about the 100 Gunner. The names are similar. Cut me a break, y'all. So the 100 Gunner is the analog to the Arsenal fight that we're going to run into momentarily in Remake.
This is something I mentioned in a previous recording, was we saw the Valkyrie in the Ascension to the upper city, right? And I was saying that the Valkyrie is like the escape pod to the giant tank. That was the impression I got. It was like all the arms are breaking off, the treads are breaking down, it's like malfunctioning by the end of the fight, and then it just blows up and the Valkyrie's there. So that's kind of was the impression I got between the two of them.
Okay, so this might be allowing Remake to inform Original, which it would be an anachronism, but we're calling 100 Gunner in Remake the Arsenal. And if an arsenal is true to its definition, a bevy of weapons, then it would follow that it would have like a last ditch mech
right
weapon up its sleeve.
Yes.
So I can see how that might work.
So at least that was always the impression I had as a kid. And so upon seeing Valkyrie in Remake, I was like, oh, I recognize that, but am I not getting the big ass tank then later in the game, because I've already seen its come to fruition moment? Kind of like it'd be if you saw the Dark Knight, the Bat Bike, before it comes out of the tumbler. Do you know what I'm talking about in that one?
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
It'd be a little bit of like it'd ruin the surprise. It'd ruin the fun of the car getting blown up and he just shoots right out of it on the bike, if you already knew the bike existed.
The element of surprise.
Yeah. So I will agree with you. The elevator fight is super interesting and compelling back in the day. I always had this thing as a kid. As an adult, you abandon it and you just learn that like this is how video games work. But I was just like mystified on having an actual explanation for how big are my characters? How big are the elevators?
Yes, we're coming back to this point from like 5 episodes ago.
Yeah. And like my kid brain just could not wrap my head around it. And so I had to either make a call. Is everything I see when I'm running around in the real world fake and battle scenes are the reality? Or are the battle scenes like these amped up expressions to give me space to play the video game, and the running around the world scenes were the real thing? And I battled this for years, because like when you see the size of the Sector 5 church and Cloud is like half the height of it, I was like, okay, this can't be it. It must be battle scenes that are telling me the truth. And so, you know, I'm glad that Remake has finally put to rest how big things really are. And we can just say the elevator is the size of a traditional elevator and doesn't need to fit the entire third floor staff in at one time,
but can support its weight.
Right.
Because the 100 Gunner probably weighs a lot.
Yes.
Right. After 100 Gunner, we fight the Heli Gunner, which we are calling an analog to the Valkyrie boss from Remake. It shoots guns and has AoE missiles. We just lightning him, and it's kind of underwhelming.
I do remember struggling with this when I was like my first time through, like being low on MP, on health, on resources. Maybe it was because my build got all fucked up via the materia swapping. I didn't know who had what at the time, you know, from the party split and everything. But yeah, I do have this like strong memory in my head of like everybody at 10% health and just like eking it out and being like, oh my god, this game is gonna give me a heart attack.
Okay.
But I mean, that was first playthrough. Later, you know, when you get the feel for how the game works, yeah, it can be a pretty easy game.
No doubt. Shall we go back to remake, Nate?
Do it.
Do it.
Do it now!
Do it now!
My goodness, where are we? Okay, so after the Cloud and Rufus fight, we have Red 13, Aerith, and Barret descending the glass elevators. We are waylaid by the Arsenal, who's in the next elevator tube over and lays gunfire on us. Now, the Arsenal is the 100 gunner that we saw in the original, and it's this giant four-wheeled mech with all kinds of weapons on it. It is a giant, giant motorized weapon system that's got lasers and ramming tools, machine guns. It is a seek and destroy juggernaut. But we cut away from that scene almost as soon as it shows up, where we go to Wedge, 64th floor, conference room. Wedge is sneaking around and he witnesses the glass elevators descending rapidly. I don't know if he got a good shot of a good visual look at who was in them, but he does see the elevators descend rapidly. And then a storm of whispers blow him backwards with such force that he crashes through a glass window and presumably to his death. But before he goes out, he calls out all of his friends' names and says, quite sadly, "Just tell me that I made a difference."
For Biggs! For Jesse! Tifa! And Barret too! I'm sorry, Cloud.
Just tell me that I made a difference.
The whispers are tidying up loose ends.
If I'm to go off of like whispers, they just hate Wedge. They're like, this fucking guy. I mean, he might as well be as bad as Sephiroth. They're like, the whispers are like, okay, we need to stop these Sephiroth intrusions. We need to get Sephiroth out of our hair, save the planet, get everything back on track. And also Wedge, that dumb piece of shit, get him out of this game right now. I'm over Wedge. And, you know, I'm liking Wedge, so I'm anti-Whisper in this respect. Fuck off, Whispers. I could see Wedge going on.
It's brief, but it's sad.
Yes.
And he's out. As far as I know, he's out. But we cut back to the action. 59th floor, back at the Skyview Hall. We engage in a fight with the Arsenal boss this time. It's a fight between, well, Red 13's in it, but he's not a playable character, and Barret and Aerith. I've got the harebrained idea that Barret's going to have one of his melee weapons for this fight and be like a tank and mage fight. And that is super fucking wrong on how to handle this, especially in phase one, where he's got all these defensive drones that you need to, that are floating and in a, I seem to recall a triangle
right
formation above the mech. And you need to take those down quite promptly. And you can't do that if you've got the scissor claw or whatever it was. And so I game over on the Arsenal boss after just a few minutes because the thing is ramming Barret. He's not tanking like I'm expecting him to. And we're not making forward progression through the phases like I want to because I've relegated most of my ranged damage to Aerith. And it really takes the both of them. So fail.
Following that same trend of like knowing exactly what I need to do in a fight, this was one where I was like, oh, I see pillars. I see debris. This guy's going to do a big charge laser. He's going to do like a thing where he has a barrier in one direction and I'm going to have a character flank from the side in order to deal extra damage or, you know, stagger him while the other one is occupying him or something. So it was like this thing that me as a experienced gamer, it wasn't necessarily easy. Like you said, you died maybe because of build issues, but it wasn't for me either. There were points where I was back and forth, but the entire time I was like, I know what I need to do. I need to just work it out on how I'm going to do it, you know? And so very satisfying, very, like you said, and we've said throughout our podcast here, is like tactile of I see the thing happening. I know where to go. Is my response timing good enough? Did I save the resources I need to save to pull off? I think there's like a tight damage window towards the end too, where you can kind of like blow everything you've got. But if you don't have any MP left, oh, yeah, you're going to be in trouble. So, you know, things like that where it was just, it all kind of came together. It was a lot of fun.
It's a chaotic fight. There's a lot going on, man. That's the first thing you've got to do. But then also over the course of the fight, the boss's weapons will appear as discrete targets. Like, you know, and it's not just Arsenal, it's Arsenal and then this weapon and this sub-weapon that you can target. When I researched this boss, I didn't figure it out organically. But if you can overpower or you focus shot it while it's charging, that ability, which is the only time it appears as a discrete target, you can cancel the arsenal's major attack.
Right.
And it will qualify as damage to the main target, although the discrete target doesn't have any health. Interesting. Max Fury will also cancel it too. The wheels are targetable after phase one, but I never really targeted that personally. In other phases, it can cycle between elemental defenses. It can ram you. Red 13 participates as well. And he can cast abilities. Like, he's got that Stardust Ray that he'll actually cast. I noticed in my fight, at least. And then in the final phase, we get a super death beam called Cry Havoc, which will instantly game over you. But the first time the arsenal uses it, it'll destroy the one last remaining pillar in the room that you can hide behind, but you've got to blow him up or finish the fight before he completes the charge for the second instance of Cry Havoc, or you will have to replay this fight over again. And I really don't want to do that. Thankfully, I only died because of my silliness with the melee weapon on Barret, and I made it through the second time. When the fight's over, Barret does something very uncharacteristic. He sits down and goes cross-legged on the floor, and he celebrates about how good it is have lived through that. And I don't get it. I don't get why that was the punctuation mark at the end of this scene.
Yeah, I think maybe the only time we've ever seen anything like that is him in Cosmo Canyon sitting by a campfire. That's the only time that he isn't running around wiggling his arms in the air, you know. So yeah, it's interesting where he get that brief moment, him not charged up to 11.
In the lobby, in Remake, because I feel like I'm on a roll here with Remake, Barret, Aerith, and Tifa arrive, and we're surrounded by Shinra forces quite quickly, and Heidegger's here too, and he asks, well, who do we have here? And it is here where they address themselves in a similar sort of way where they did to Rufus in Original just a few scenes ago. Avalanche, local florist, lab rat dog.
What is this ragtag group of misfits I see before me?
Avalanche!
Local florist!
Lab rat dog.
And then Cloud rolls in on a motorcycle and power slides through most of them. I mean, this is legit Roche shit right now.
Roche could tell that Cloud was always longing to have that fat, fucking hardy Daytona between his legs instead of the dinky little dirt bike that Jesse gave him. Cloud is in full Roche mode.
Tifa rolls in on a dorky green truck and the rest pile into it. Cloud dispatches the rest of the anonymous Shinra troops, but lets Heidegger live. And when he does let Heidegger live, he power slides and gets the rear wheel like right up against his nose. It's real dramatic and Zack Snyder-y, I'll just put it that way. Cloud lets Heidegger live, although he kills everybody else. And I'm sure the Whisperers were pretty worried about that. They would have had to send the medic Whisper to take care of Heidegger if Cloud got even a few inches closer than he really did. But his precision is incredible. Anyways, the motorcycle and the truck cruise through the lobby to the front doors. One last grunt stands in our way. Cloud throws his sword at him and it pierces the glass window just inches away from this dude, and he relents. I don't know why we have to do this. Maybe this is Console. Fuck off, Console. Cloud's motorcycle explodes through the window, and the two vehicles hit the Shinra highway outside the building. Chapter over.
Right.
All right, and so we're going to sustain this energy to talk about Lobby in Original.
There's a brief section of you're given Tifa, the floor below the main office, and she has to, like, run around and go find Cloud upstairs. Remake has this moment where, like, in after the Rufus fight, Cloud kind of like he wins the fight but loses in the cutscene.
Yes.
He's hanging off the building and Tifa rescues him.
You're right. Thank you for reminding me of that. And that we got a note of that somewhere, but we've been bebopping around between the two games so rapidly.
Yes. So in Remake, Tifa has to get back up there and like it's this dramatic last second save that she gives. Whereas in OG, she's just running up there to be like, hey, Cloud, we really need to go. Like, we're in trouble.
I was like, fucking no.
Yeah, so we kind of bounce back between grabbing Tifa to go upstairs, then back to the crew that's in the lobby. And yeah, then we get our little groundbreaking cutscene here. Was this a moment for you as a kid?
The song Crazy Motorcycle begins to play. It starts with this kind of like techno trickle of beeps and boops, and then it ascends into this like, you know, high energy you know, driving song. And yeah, this movie was pretty rad. Over the course of the FMV that plays, the gang strolls across the lobby to see Cloud riding down the lobby's large staircases on this hog. Tifa finds the dorky truck, she fires it up, and everybody piles in. Cloud crashes through a crystal glass corporate art installation, and the two vehicles drive up a level, pause to gather ourselves, and then Cloud crashes through a pane of glass, landing on the Midgar highway below. The truck also sticks the landing quite perfectly, and then the two vehicles disappear behind a bend in the highway as sirens blare behind them.
At the beginning of the game, we saw kind of the highest quality model of Aerith. Eris that we are ever going to see in OG, right? But this is the first time you get to see that level of model out of Cloud, Barret, Tifa, and Red, because in all previous scenes of FMVs, it's the Reactor 5 explosion happening and Cloud falling to the ground below. Those are all the Lego versions. They are not rendered in the quality that they are rendered here. So this is the first time you're getting a look in game at some of these people's like full bodies outside of fights. And Barret looks even huger than his like battle counterpart.
His shoulders are squarer.
Yeah, and he gets into the back of that truck and fills the whole fucking thing, the truck bed, pretty much. And then you also get a look at Tifa's full model there, and yeah.
Full model, huh? Yeah. Yeah. It is a fun scene. I should also point out that before this FMV plays in OG, that we get a chance to stroll around the lobby area for a little bit. I go back to that store, and you still can't open those boxes that I described a few episodes ago. The automobile movie in the same shop doesn't play anymore. And again, before the movie plays, there is a Barret notices that there's a perimeter of forces outside the building holding us in. And Barret seems ready to turn this into a suicide mission, but he won't because Cloud has charged him with protecting Aerith. It's at that point, when Barret comes to that realization, that Tifa and Cloud catch up to us. This episode has been a production of Gunblade Guys. That's us, Tyler and Nate. Think about liking us, subscribing to us, five-starring us, writing a review about us, and telling a fellow game liker about us as well. If you love this show, someone you know probably would love this show too. Join the conversation with fellow fans of the show on Discord. You can find a link to our Discord server in our podcast description paragraph. You can also tip us at a link in that description as well, if you please. Catch us on Twitch and YouTube under the name Gunblade Guys. And if you feel like leaving us an email, don't think about leaving it at gunbladeguys@gmail.com.
You can volunteer to edit our episodes for us, provide childcare, or perhaps loan us a car, because I just was having issues with mine. That you can do all that too, if you like, just throwing it out there.
And I'm moving soon, and I could really use a hand moving some of my furniture. So let me know if you're available on the 25th, and we'll sort out some time.
Does anyone have a Ford F-250 to bring to Eau Claire, Wisconsin by the 25th? The F-150 ain't gonna cut it.
Ain't gonna cut it. No. We'll just look at the Menards parking lot and take our pick.
Yeah.
There are two Menards in the city, by the way. We live in the home of John Menard. This is Menard's land.
You are in the Nexus. Their energies converge between...
Oh, God.
Between the DC Center in Halley, then Menards West and Menards East. There's a like a Bermuda Triangle of John Menard just siphoning off your energy to live...
Oh, you're not done yet.
Yeah.
There's a corporate center and a convention center.
Right. Oh, yeah. And well, didn't he also, his name's on the hospital, right?
What? Not
there's,
that I'm aware
There's like
of.
A John Menard wing of Mayo Clinic.
Oh, that might be. Yeah. That might be.
So anyway, I got out, but he's still siphoning your life force to achieve immortality through all of his nexus points.
He's my local President Shinra.
I don't know. Maybe this is spoilers, but in the show Full Metal Alchemist, they eventually realize like the people, the main characters, they like take a step back and look at the maps of like all of the cities and the countries surrounding. And they realize that the like, leader of the nation has crafted the nation to be one big transmutation circle to cast one giant spell. And they're like, fuck, we are like all going to die. So yeah, that was like a moment I'm referencing here with the John Menard location. With
John Menard.
Yeah.
But instead of alchemy, it's trusses for houses and yeah, light fixtures. And
all right,
let's get out of here. Peace next out. Week you're getting motorballed.
Let's rev those balls, baby.
We're gonna motorboat your balls. I just squirted myself with this saline solution in the nose. I had my follow-up appointment with that ENT doc.
Right.
Who did the surgery, and he asked me how often I'm using this nasal spray. And I said, when I'm feeling dry. And he said, no, do it 3 or 4 times a day.
Okay.
And so we're gonna, so I'm hydrated back there now.
Is that more or less than you were doing?
More. It's more. I've been doing it way, not as frequent as I should be.
Gotcha.
Probably less than double, less than half or less. I can't hear fucker.
Well, doctors always say, like, whatever question they ask you and you answer, they double it. So if, like, if they say, how many drinks do you have a week? And you're like, oh, 4 or 5. The doctor writes down 8 or 10 because everybody lies about things you do. So he was probably guessing that every other time you were feeling dry, you were giving it a squirt, and he wanted to up your game even more. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I've experienced that in other ways too. Like, this was a long time ago. I told my doctor I smoke marijuana, and he put me down as a tobacco smoker, and it affected my health insurance. My health insurance went up.
Great.
And I went back to him and told him that I'm not a tobacco smoker. And he goes, well, when you say you smoke weed, that falls under a family of substances that we call tobacco.
Right.
And so that makes you a tobacco smoker, and your premiums deserve to go up on account of that.
I just got the beep that my headphones are dying. So I'm joining the grid.
You're plugging in.
I'm jacking on.
Finally.
All right. Should we shoot this piece of shit?
Yeah, let's do it.
To quote Harrison Ford.
When did he say that?
He was filming a Marvel movie recently, and somebody on set said that he apparently said, like, at a morning meeting, or, you know, the pep talk before you start filming. I can hear that, by the way. He apparently told everybody, all right, let's go shoot this piece of shit.
This dude is done acting. All I want to do is drive helicopters in Montana.
Crash helicopters in Montana.
Psych. All right.
Should I try?
Hi, everybody.
Oh, should I try a heavy compressor? Give me 1 second. If I talk really quiet, does it boost it up? As opposed to now, if I talk really quiet, it does. It boosts it. The heavy compressor. I'm going to try it today.
Maybe I should. Where is it?
This is in my Shure mic setup. I've got layers and layers of failure here, of not knowing what the fuck I'm doing.
Dude,
you're going to have so many outtakes. Don't even.
You're pretty spare last time.
I'm just going to leave all this in, and you can move it where you find appropriate. You can start the episode where you feel like it. I'll do a edit straight. No rearranging.
Word. Shall I begin?
Yeah. So with the new house?
What's the deal with it?
With the new house, is your space going to be more official in a way?
Yeah. So the basement's got doesn't have wide open spaces. It's got mini hallway, largish room, and then the largish room has nooks that spin off into 3 different directions. One goes into the laundry room, one goes into more storage and around a corner towards the furnace, and the other one is just a dead end, quote unquote dead end nook. And I think I'll just take the quote unquote dead end nook. It's much wider than this one is.
Right.
And I think it's going to work out really well. I asked my wife, when she was there with the inspector, to look at, like, power in the basement and if it would be suitable. And she said that there's, like, outlets all over the goddamn place, and that they might have had the basement rewired 10 or 20 years ago.
Right.
On account of doing more things in the basement, which is perfect.
Perfect. You're going to have room to put a big, like, shelf with all your gaming memorabilia in the background.
There is a lot of inset shelving. That's not the word, but I forget what it's called. There's a lot of that around. And depending on how I get that organized, maybe. I don't have a lot of memorabilia, honestly. I mean, I have more books than anything else, really.
And you gotta have that gamer background.
Oh, God. Maybe. Can I just green screen and you can just see my little head superimposed over whatever?
Yeah, if you want a legit. Because you've used that, like, auto green screen where it's like,
yeah,
it's like the void is eating the sides of your head trying to figure out what's you. But that's if you throw a legit green screen behind you, then by all means, that'd be sick.
I do have a legit green screen, but I also think the auto green screen works. Well, I mean, it takes some tweaking, but works fairly as well. But I guess it's up for interpretation, isn't it, Nate?
Yeah. You know me. I do what I can to make it pretty.
Excuse me. Okay. What happens next?
IMDb, baby. Can I have FF7 on IMDb? I don't know what it is. The answer is no. It wants me to look up Advent Children. That would be a mistake because I'm guessing it's a different voice actor for Rufus. Yeah, Rufus.
Ooh. Should reapply the saline spray. I don't know why I'm so like, I feel like I have no moisture in my mouth. What time are we at?
You know why? You, reading the notes. We're at an hour and a half, basically.
An hour and a half.
Reading the notes here, you get your lab rat dog moment here with Heidegger, not with Rufus.
Is that right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to post-production Tyler that nonsense too.
Hey, I'm trying to make it easy for you. I'll give you a trim cut.
Yeah, I guess we could just delete that and we'll have to correct it.
Yeah, I can see. I'll look at the script and see where it makes sense to just splice it out.
I definitely have done that in previous episodes, which you've probably noticed, making me sound right when I have been wrong. Shameful. The lobby. At the lobby, and we've got crazy motorcycle. All right, we don't have much more to go. I'm stalling. Let's go. I just did a minute ago.
You did? Did I, like, am I dumb? All right, great.
No. Probably not.
Okay.
I don't think you're done.
It might be getting late for me, but yeah.
Yeah, I can believe it.
Okay. Cutting all this.
Let's chug a lug through this.
Yeah. Keep going. Take her away.
Sure. Keep going.
Yeah. You're headed back there real soon. Because
you've
got a new house that your wife is going to be like, I don't know that I like the color on this room. I'm thinking more of like a peach.
Oh, gross.
I don't know if your wife's like that at all.
I don't even know, man, because she moved into this house. I mean, my former wife and I bought this first house, and so she moved into a house that had already been kind of decided, or at least she didn't get a hand in deciding, and now she gets a hand in deciding this one, and so she feels a much more ownership.
Right.
As she should. She's on the mortgage, too, as she should. And so with that comes some, you know, executive decisions that she didn't really feel like she could make before. And fair play to her. That's fine. Make your home. Make your nest.
That little impersonation I was giving was me channeling first wife energy from my side, not making any judgment calls on your marital situation.
I ain't worried about that.
Yasumi Matsuno just gave a recommendation that we all go play Unicorn Overlord, the game that takes several tactical elements from games that he's made in the past, except that on his Twitter post he called it Unicorn Overload instead of...
Oh, that's right. I saw that. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. And before even seeing his tweet, I had made a joke when I was playing the demo. I was like, there's too many R's in the title. I'm so compelled to call it Unicorn Overload. Like, this game just has too many fucking unicorns. But yeah, I was like, it made me laugh so hard because I was like, not even he can get away from it. We're all mispronouncing this awful game name. Wonderful game, terrible name.